For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
It is May the 13th. We're on page 700 in Parshas Bahar, Pasuk Chaf Hei, verse 25. When your brother shall become impoverished, umachar me'achuzaso, he'll sell from his inheritance, from his land, uvogalo akarov elav, and his redeemer who is close to him, meaning who's related to him, will come, v'gaal es mimkar achiv, and will redeem that which was sold by his brother. Which means that the relative, the immediate relative, has the right of redeeming the land. If the owner can't purchase the land back, then the brother or close relative could buy it back. V'ish ki lo goel, someone who doesn't have a redeemer, he doesn't have anybody who can buy the land back. V'hisiga yodo, and then his hand reaches, which means he finds some money, he gets some money. U'matza kidegu laso, and now he has enough money to purchase back the land. V'chishaves shnei mimkaro, he shall consider the years of his sale. V'heishives ha'odef la'isha shemachar lo, and he will return the extra amount to the man that he had sold it to, which means he'll prorate it. He'll figure out how much money, how many years this field had already been sold for, how much that was worth, and then how much is left, and then he'll prorate and pay the difference. V'shav l'achuzaso, and he'll return to his inheritance. V'imlo matz'o yado de hashiv lo, if he can't find the money to pay back. V'ayomim karo biyad ha'kone oso, it will remain in the hands of the one who bought it. Achnas ha'yovel, until the year of Yovel. V'yotza ba'yovel, it will go out in Yovel. V'shav l'achuzaso, and then he will return to his inheritance. So, yeah.
No, I have a question.
Okay, so this is the general rule that we already mentioned last week, that if you sell land, your own land, talking about land that you own, you sold it in Israel during the time when there is a Yovel, then the original owner can purchase back the land. We said last time, I believe we mentioned last time, that you have to give him a grace period of 2 years. You can't buy it back in the first 2 years, but after the first 2 years, then the original owner can buy it back. The purchaser cannot stop the original owner from buying it back. The price of the field is the price that it was bought for, prorated. So that means if it was sold 30 years before Yovel for $300,000, then that means each year is considered $10,000, $300,000 divided by 30. So if you purchase it back 10 years later, then the purchase price is a fixed $200,000. It does not go up or down. That is the price that it would cost to purchase the land back. Here we learn that not only can the original owner buy it back, but so can his immediate relative. His brother can buy it back. An immediate relative can buy the land back as well on behalf of the original owner. And of course, if no one is able to buy it back, then in Yovel it goes back to the original owner. Yeah.
Now, I'm just wondering how this would work practically, whatever the word would be. You know, if somebody had things planted on the land, they had bought it and they had things planted, and 5 years later someone comes and says, okay, I want to buy it back. I mean, do you think people maybe then would lease it to him and he wouldn't be the owner, or he would just lose everything that he
has no choice. He can't keep it.
No, he can keep it, but could he lease it?
If the other person allows him to.
But otherwise, they don't have to do that.
This, as we mentioned last time, there is no incentive for anybody but the owner to develop the land. Yeah. If you purchase the land, it is strictly for immediate gain. You're going to plant crops, harvest the crops. You're not going to do anything that's going to have long-lasting value, because you're not going to want to put the money up to do that, because he could buy it back at any time after 2 years. He can buy it back.
Is there any way of calculating a possibility of a drought or a cropless year?
So the Gemara says that the minimum 2 year requirement that the seller has to allow the purchaser to hold on to it for a minimum of 2 years is 2 years that have the potential to produce crops. So for example, let's say one of those years is Shemitah, then that will not count towards the 2 years. It has to be 2 years during which time he can produce crops. Now he could produce, theoretically, three harvests during those 2 years if he can work the land properly. He might be able to produce more, but it has to be a minimum of 2 years of crops. If he chooses not to plant in the land, and that's why there's no crops, that's his own fault. But it has to be 2 years that there can be crops. So the Gemara discusses a year where it was impossible to grow anything because of a drought. There's a discussion about whether or not that counts towards the 2 years. It wasn't Shemitah, but physically it was impossible to grow anything that year. So that's a discussion in the Gemara. But your question, I believe, is moving forward, I'm going to buy the land back now, so can we calculate the years that there won't be any crops? The answer is no, that it's still prorated based on the years to Yovel, irrespective of whether those years are going to be crop-producing years or not. Now, putting ourselves into the mindset of those living in Israel during the time that Yovel was in effect is hard to do. And we mentioned a little bit about this last week, and we'll talk about it again tonight, which is that it's difficult to envision a real estate market where, as we mentioned last week, first of all, all land always depreciates. It's not an investment. There's never an appreciation of land. It always depreciates because the closer you get to Yovel, the less it's worth. And when you do hit Yovel, you have to give the land back. So you never gain anything. There's no investment value to land that is not your family plot. And as we mentioned tonight, therefore there is no incentive to develop the land. In fact, there's a disincentive to develop the land unless it's your family plot. If it's your family plot, you have great incentive to develop the land because you're never going to lose it. So for families on their own plots, there's a huge incentive to develop the land. Mm-hmm. Because it's always going to remain with you and your family. It's never going to leave. But for anybody else, there is never an incentive to develop the land. So the real estate market is a completely different type of market. You add into that, of course, the fact that you can't charge any interest. So you end up with a completely different type of economic system with real estate than you have here. But now you have another factor, which is that If Reuven sells you land in Israel, and then you get it for a minimum of 2 years, after 2 years, Reuven is allowed to purchase it back, and you cannot stop him. You prorate the amount, and he can purchase it back. If he doesn't have the cash on hand to do it, which is likely, which is probably why he sold the land in the first place, but Reuven's brother can purchase it back, and you can't stop Reuven's brother from purchasing it back. Or another close relative of Reuven's. When we learned on Wednesday evening shiur many years ago, we learned Megillas Rus, which is coming up on Shavuos, we explained that that's what's going on in the Megillah. You see, in the Megillah we have, in the third and fourth chapters, we have that Rus and Naomi are selling land. They're selling their land in Israel. And there's a discussion about the Goel, about the Redeemer. And Ruth comes to Boaz at Naomi's behest. Naomi tells her, go to Boaz and ask him to both marry you and to redeem the land. And Boaz says to her, I will do so, but there is a closer Redeemer than me. Yesh goel karov mimeni. There's someone who is a closer relative than me. And he says, if Tov, which was his name, if he redeems, fine, and if not, then I will do so. I swear by Hashem's name that I will do so. And then the fourth chapter, you have the drama of Boaz convening a Beis Din, and the relative comes by, and they discuss it. First the relative says, I will redeem, then Boaz it tells him he has to marry Ruth. He says, I don't want to marry Ruth. He won't redeem. Therefore, Boaz marries Ruth and redeems the land. That's what happens over there. So the whole discussion of redeeming land is funny. What does that mean? What does that have to do with marrying Ruth? And what does that have to do with being in the order of, I mean, they're selling the land right now. Rus and Naomi are coming to sell the land. What does that have to do with the Redeemer? So we explained this at the time. I want to give you an insight into how it works, since it's coming up next in just a few days with Megillas Rus. You should understand what's happening over there. It's the least understood part, I think, of Megillas Rus. So what's happening? Yes. Maybe we'll look at the psukim. I don't know if we have to. The way it works is as follows. I'm going to actually put the family tree on the board, because you'll be able to envision how the land works better if you see the family tree. The Rus, let's take Naomi, because Naomi, Rus is a convert. So Naomi, though, is a Jewess, a born Jewess. So let's take her. Naomi's grandfather was the famous Nachshon ben Aminadav, the one who jumped into the Red Sea first, and it split because it got up to his nose. The prince of the tribe of Yehuda actually mentioned this week's parsha for the first time. Not for the first time, but he has mentioned this week's parsha. So Nachshon, we'll call him he's the grandfather. Nachshon. So he's Nachshon. Nachshon has four sons. He has four sons. So he has Elimelech, who is mentioned in the beginning of Megillas Rus, and then dies. Mm-hmm. He has, we'll call him Naomi's father. Put that a little too close together. But that's another son. Obviously, he has Naomi. Naomi marries her uncle. She's married to Elimelech when the Megillah begins. They have two sons. I'm going to put them backwards because I got to get... Rus marries Mahlon, the older one. So I got to put them on the other side. So we'll put Kilion and Mahlon. Okay, then there is a third son whose name is Tov, and then there's a fourth son whose name is Salma or Salmon. It's mentioned two different ways. We'll call it Salmon, and his son is Boaz. Boaz and Naomi are first cousins. They're first cousins. You know that Mahlon marries Rus. When Elimelech dies and Kilion dies and Mahlon dies, eventually Boaz marries Rus, and from there comes Oved, Yishai, and then David. Okay, that's the story of Megillas Rus. Now let's look at this through the lens of our parsha. Let's look at it using land. Nachshon has land. Now, even though he may not make it to Israel, because the whole generation dies out, but nevertheless, he has four sons, each of whom have a portion in Israel. So that means when our Megillah opens up, we have Elimelech, who has a portion in Israel, one quarter of Nachshon's land. We have Naomi. Naomi's father is no longer alive. We don't know of any siblings, so we presume that Naomi also has a quarter of the land. We have Tov, who has a quarter of the land. Salmon is no longer alive. Boaz has a quarter of the land. So each of these four people has one quarter of the land. Now here's the rule. A wife does not inherit a husband. Neither does she inherit sons. As we'll learn in Parshas Pinchas, a mother does not inherit sons, and a wife does not inherit her husband. So when Mahlon and Kilion and Elimelech die, what happens to their quarter of the land? It goes back to Nachshon. Nachshon is no longer alive. And then it gets divided up amongst his living children, which means Nami's father, who's no longer alive, so Nami takes his place. Tov and Salma's no longer alive, so Boaz takes his place. Each get a third of Elimelech's property. So now, Nami, not through inheritance as a wife, but through inheritance as a granddaughter of Nachshon, Nami, Tov, and Boaz now have a quarter of the land plus another third of a quarter. Right? Which essentially means they end up with each having a third of Nachshon's land. A quarter, they get to it through their own line, and then another little bit from Elimelech's line. So they each now have a third of Nachshon's property. That's what they have. When they come to Israel, Nami and Rus are destitute. They had been very, very, very wealthy. They lost all their money. Now they're destitute. They need to sell their land. What land? This third of the property that of Nachshon's. That's what they want to sell. Now, this is putting yourself in the mindset. Think about this for a moment. Nami wants to sell her land. She could sell to anybody. Anybody might purchase the land. So I say, I'll purchase the land. Well, if I purchase the land, I'll hold on to it for 2 years. But then, even if Nami doesn't have the money, either Tov or Boaz could come and force me to sell it to them. So I'm not going to be so quick in a hurry to run to buy Nami's land.
But what about what it produces?
Wait, we'll get there. Hold on. So I'm not going to be so quick to go buy Nami's land. Because even though she may not have any money, and I may predict that she will not have the money to force me to sell it back to her for the next 20 years, so I'll get land for 20 years, but it's not so simple. Because both Tov and Boaz could force me to sell the land back to them after 2 years. So I'm going to be on the fence about Nami's land. Who will step forward to buy Nami's land? Tov and Boaz. Because they don't have the risk of another relative coming and buying it, because they are the relatives, number one. Number two, since there is a mitzvah for them to redeem the land, if I, who am not a family member, buy Nami's land, it would then be a mitzvah on Tov and Boaz, who are relatives, to come and purchase it from me. So let's skip the middleman. Skip Pransky, and let them go directly and buy it from Nami. There's no reason for her to sell to me, and then they come buy it from me. Just sell it straight to them. So in Israel, it became common practice that if you needed to sell land, you just skipped the middleman and sold it to the closest redeemer first. That would be your first choice. Because anyway, it's going to be his mitzvah to buy it from whoever you sell it to. And he doesn't have the risk of someone else buying it away from him. So, therefore, the natural thing to do when you were looking to sell land was to go to the closest relative first. That was the way it normally worked. Now, if Tov wouldn't have the money, and Boaz wouldn't have the money, and Nami doesn't have any money, well, now there's incentive for me to buy the land, because I'll be able to hold on to it, hopefully for a long time. But since they did have money, therefore, the incentive for me is very, very low, and for them is very, very high. That's what's going on over there in the Megillah. That's why when they talk about selling the land, they're going to the closest relative. What does that have to do with marrying Rus? So there Rashi explains, because since really the land belonged to Mahlon, to Kilion, to Elimelech, so if whoever buys the land will then marry Rus, then Rus will be seen on the land, and then people will remember her deceased husband. It'll be a way of remembering Mahlon, because they'll see his widow on the land. If someone else would purchase the land and not marry her, then she's not going to be anywhere near the land. This way, his widow will be found on his land. It'll be a way of remembering the name of Mahlon. That was why they linked the two things together. But that's what's going on in Megillas Rus, that they go, and that's why when Rus goes to Boaz and says, marry me and redeem the land, Boaz says, I will do it. I swear I will do it. However, there's someone who's ahead of me in line, because I'm only a cousin to Nami, and a first cousin once removed to Machlon. But Tov is an uncle to Nami and a great uncle of Machlon. He is the closer relative.
So why didn't Nami send her to Tov first? Did she know he was alive?
Because she did, but she knew that Boaz was the right person. She knows a lot, right? She knows what's going on. So Nami wanted it to be Boaz, and it ends up being Boaz. Tov is not really willing to marry Rus, right, but Boaz is. So but that's what's happening with the land and the marriage of Rus in the Megillah. That's why you have this discussion of land. They each would have been purchasing land that was actually next to their own properties. It's not land off someplace else, because they're related, which the land all had been one big plot of Nachshon's, so the land was divided up into first into quarters, then into thirds, so they're buying land that is next to their own properties, which is, by the way, another reason why a close relative would prefer to buy the land rather than somebody else, because if it's me who's buying the land from Nami, and I'm from a different tribe, my land is way over there, her land is way over there, it's hard to care for properties that are not contiguous. But if you have property right next to her property, you certainly do want to have her land, because then your land is contiguous. You can plow the whole thing at once, reap the whole thing at once, all one process. It saves a lot of money.
Nothing had, all those years that Elimelech, when they were away, their land just...
It's very likely that he had servants who were working the land. He had left a very wealthy man.
I like the detail. But he was the only one. I mean, there was a famine and all.
Yeah, so I don't know. Could be nothing grew that during that time. Now, your question was about...
If I have a good crop and
yes,
I want to expand it, that's fine. I'll just take this for 2 years, because it's the crop I care about.
Right, right. But that's a very short-term gain.
Right.
Yeah, there's no long-term gain there. It's all very short-term. Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
Just as a little aside, are there any different... halachic practices in regard to burial during the Shemitah and the Yovel?
Not that I know of. I don't know, but I don't know of any. Okay, so here in this paragraph we just read, you have this rule of the redeemer of the land. And if there is no redeemer, then it goes back to the original owner in the Yovel here. Pasuk Chavtes, verse 29. V'ish kim kar beis moshav irchama. If a man will sell a house, a dwelling house, in a city that is in a walled city, then here are the rules. V'yisagu laso ad tom shnas mim karo. So the redemption of the house is up until the end of the year of its sale. Yamim tiagula, so the redemption shall be for up to a year, which means the original owner can buy back the house within the year. Vim lo yigael, but if he doesn't redeem it, ad melos lo shana simima, until a complete year is finished, then v'kam habayis asher bo'ir asher lo choma, then the city that is in the city, that, excuse me, the house that is in the city that has a wall will... come here means it'll
pass.
Okay, latzmisus, permanently lakoneoso, to the one who purchased it, lidorosav, for all the generations. Lo yetzei vayovel, will not go out in yovel. So a house in a walled city is really the opposite of a field. A field, as we already learned before, you cannot purchase it back for the first 2 years. After that point, you can force the buyer to sell it back to you at a prorated price. Here it's the reverse. If a person sells a home, a house, in a walled city, then for the first year, the one who sells the house, the seller, can force the buyer to sell it back to him for the same price. So if I sold this house in a walled city to you for $100,000, during that first year, If I come up with $100,000, I want to buy it back. You cannot stop me. You must sell me the house back. But after a year, if I miss the deadline of a year, then the house becomes yours permanently. So where it comes to fields, there we had that the land is always going back to the original owner, and the family keeps the plot of land. But when it comes to a house in a walled city, there you can move around. It goes from one person to another person, and over the course of time, the houses can change hands. Many different people can own the home on a permanent basis. If after a year the original owner does not buy it back, then it becomes permanently owned by the new owner. The walled city that we're talking about is a city that was walled in the days of Yehoshua bin Nun, similar to the rules of Purim, where we know that Purim is celebrated on the 14th of Adar, except for those cities that have been walled from the days of Yehoshua bin Nun. They celebrate on the 15th of Adar, plus Yerushalayim also celebrates on the 15th of Adar. Here as well, a city that is walled from the days of Yehoshua bin Nun, there, even if today the wall no longer exists, those houses are subject to this rule that if the one who sells the land can buy it back for the first year, and after that, if he does not buy it back, it becomes permanently owned by the purchaser. So it's a completely opposite halacha from what we had with fields that are not able to be purchased back in the first 2 years, and then after that they can always be purchased back, and a yovel goes back to the original owner. Here that does not work.
Even with yovel, should
you want to go back? Yovel does not make the house go back to the original owner. Yeah.
How many walled cities were there?
Not sure how many walled cities there were. It's a good question. The Gemara does list several.
Seven.
Yeah, but I don't know what counts. I'm not sure. Now, there was a practice that developed that needed to be addressed. And the practice was that, think about this for a moment. I purchase your home in a walled city, and now you have the right to buy it back for a year. But obviously you sold me the house because you needed the cash, so you don't have cash right away. Okay, you're hoping to find cash before the end of the year. I'm hoping that you do not find cash before the end of the year because I want to keep the home. Mm-hmm. So I bought it from you in May, and we go through the summer, we go through the fall, and now it's the winter time. You have not yet purchased the home back, and I am very much hoping that you will not be able to. It's January, it's February, it's March, we go through Pesach, and now it's late April, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, he hasn't or she hasn't purchased the home back. A few more weeks is all I need, and then the house is mine forever. But I'm concerned, because you also know the deadline is fast approaching, and therefore you're going to be doing anything you can to find money to buy back. In fact, you may actually borrow money to buy back. Well, I don't want that to happen. So since I can't destroy your credit rating or steal your identity, so what am I going to do? So I say to myself, I'll make myself scarce. I will take a sudden vacation to Antarctica. Let them try to find me. And that way, if I can go into hiding until the anniversary of the purchase date, and you can't find me, well, the house is mine.
It's unethical to do that.
It may be unethical, but business is business. It's unethical, but there's no halacha that you're violating.
Really?
It's not okay. Nice. You're not acting like a mensch. But you didn't. There's no avera. It doesn't say in the Torah you can't do that. So I will simply make myself scarce, and if you can't find me, sorry, it'll be mine. That's a very, very, very big incentive to do that, to try to get away. So this became a problem. So therefore, Chazal instituted that in the event that the original owner cannot, excuse me, in the event that the purchaser cannot be found as you approach the deadline, then the original owner can deposit the money with Beis Din. That will be considered buying back the house. when the purchaser shows up, he can go to Beis Din and collect his money. But Beis Din will hold on to the money in escrow till the purchaser shows up. The original owner now owns the house. And if the purchaser has installed a lock on the door for which the original owner doesn't have the key, he may break down the door and re-enter his own home. This is a Mishnah. That was the practice that was set up in order to undermine this unethical, but technically legal process. So you read today about people who come up with methods that are technically legal, but are obviously not ethical in order to make money or to take other people's money. It's not a new thing. It's always been this way. That people try to get around. I mean, people do things that are illegal, but even legal, people do things that kind of, you know, are not in the spirit of the law, but they are able to make money on the deal.
Nothing
so
new under the sun.
Nothing new. That's right. So Chazal, in order to undermine that practice, made this rule that the money can be paid to Beis Din, and then the original owner can enter his home, even if it means breaking the door. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Is the boundary of this town by the dimensions of the wall?
Yes. Yes. So you're saying if the wall fell down...
No, if the town extended beyond the wall.
Yeah. Yeah. So it would still be... as far as I understand, it should be bounded by the wall. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What did they do in the instances where there would be a leap year, an extra month?
Yeah. So that goes in favor of the original owner, meaning you have 13 months to buy it back.
Okay.
It's a full year to buy it back.
So it's really the Hebrew date, not the English date.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
What
does
that rule?
So the Torah says, it's a good question. It's a good question. It seems that walled cities ended up becoming not international, but intertribal, meaning that walled cities had the capacity to become lived in and owned by many different tribes. As you have a walled city in the tribe of Yehuda, so over time, through the sale of houses, all the tribes can end up living within the walled city. Whereas the land around in Yehuda would always remain within Yehuda, except for, we'll learn a few exceptions, but generally, they would remain within Yehuda, because even if people of Yehuda would sell to someone from, let's say, Zevulun, but at Yovel, it goes back to the original owner. So the land remains clearly defined by the tribe of Yehuda. But the walled city does not necessarily remain that way. So that's what ends up happening. I can't tell you that's why the Torah does this, but that is the result over time. Now, there's one more category, which we're about to talk about, which is houses that are not in walled cities. We talked about fields. We talked about houses in walled cities. What about homes that are not in walled cities? So as we're about to see, homes that are not in walled cities are going to be hybrids. They're going to have the rule of fields and the rule of houses in walled cities, as we'll see, all in favor of the original owner. So the Pasuk says, Lamed Aleph, verse 21.
30.
I'm sorry, 31, thank you. Uvatei hachatzeirim, homes, as they say, in open towns. Asher ein lahem choma saviv, they don't have a wall around them. Al sedei haaretz yechashev, they will be considered on the field of the land, which is geula tialo, they can be redeemed forever, which means they can be redeemed right away and forever. There is no deadline. There is no grace period, as there are with fields. There's also no deadline. They can be redeemed any time. And if they're not redeemed, uva yovel yetze. Then in the yovel year, they go back to the original owner. So homes that are not in a walled city have the best of both worlds for the seller, for the original owner, the worst of both worlds for the purchaser. The original owner can buy it back whenever they wish, immediately, or after 20 years, they can always buy it back. And if they don't buy it back, it goes back to them in Yovel, which means that of all types of real estate transactions in Israel, the one that had the greatest disincentive were homes outside of a walled city. There was very little incentive to purchase a home outside of a walled city from somebody else, because you had no guarantee of how long you're going to hold on to that home. You could hold on to it in theory for till the Yovel, which might be 30 years from now, or you may hold on to it for 3 days, because they come back and buy it back from you in 3 days. So it was, there was very little incentive to do so, to purchase a home from someone outside of a walled city. Now there is one other factor here, though, which does complicate the matter, which is the following. Let's think about let's take the home in a walled city for a moment. So, of course, the Torah here is not addressing renting or leasing. It's talking about purchasing. So we could always make an arrangement where I'm going to rent your home. So let's say you have two homes in a walled city. Two homes in a walled city. And you, Reuven and Shimon both approach you about your two homes. Reuven is interested in one home. Shimon is interested in the other home. So you make an arrangement with Reuven. Reuven is going to purchase your home in the walled city. The purchase price is $100,000. That gives you right now $100,000 cash on hand. Reuven will hold on to it now. You have up to a year to buy it back from Reuven. If you do, he cannot stop you. But if you don't, after a year, then Reuven owns it permanently. Shimon is interested in your other home. You don't need to sell it to him because now you have a lot of cash on hand because of Reuven's purchase. So with Shimon, you make up a deal where you're going to rent to him the home. And you say that you will rent it to him for 10 months. And the rent will be $1,000 a month. So for the next 10 months, then he will pay you $10,000 and live in your home. Okay. Reuven pays you $100,000. It's his home now, but there's a year-long time where you can get it back from him. And Shimon is paying you $1,000 a month for 10 months to live in your home. 10 months later, you manage to come up with the $100,000 that you need to buy the house back from Reuven. So you go to Reuven and you say, here's the $100,000 you paid me, and I want my home back. Reuven can't stop you. You get your home back from Reuven. Shimon is done with his 10 months of rental, and now he's done, and you get your home back. So now you have both homes back, as before. But the difference is that from Shimon, who lived in your home for 10 months, you got $10,000 of rent. From Reuven, who lived in your house for 10 months, you got zero. He paid you $100,000 for the home. You paid him back $100,000 for the home. There's no prorating over here. Reuven lived in your house for 10 months for free. Shimon lived in your house for 10 months for $10,000. So what ends up happening is that Reuven gets a free, not a free lunch, but he gets a free stay for 10 months. If you look at this with a critical eye, you can make the case that this resembles interest. Because think about it. Reuven gave you $100,000 to live in your home. After 10 months, you gave him back $100,000. You basically borrowed $100,000 from Reuven for 10 months. That's what happened. It ended up being a glorified loan. He gave you $100,000, you gave him back $100,000. But he got something else. He lived there for 10 months. Yeah. If I come to you and I say, I'd like to borrow $100,000 from you. And you say, fine. And I say, and you know what? In order to thank you for lending me the money, you can live in this rental home of mine for free for 10 months. Is that permitted? That is prohibited, because that's interest. That means I'm paying you, I'm giving you something for you having lent me $100,000. A Jew is not allowed to do that to another Jew. I cannot give you the gift of living in my rental home for free for 10 months as as a thank you or as a payment for having lent me money. You can't do that. Here, that's at the end of the day, once the dust has settled, that's essentially what happened. Reuven gave me, or gave you $100,000 to live in your home. He did for 10 months. You gave him back his money, and he walks away without a home, but without having paid either. So it turns out that you end up with something which appears to be sort of like ribis, like charging interest. The difference, of course, is that it wasn't structured that way. Meaning, it's not that the original owner came to Reuven and said, I'd like to borrow money, and here you can live in my home. That's not what happened is, Reuven came and said, I want to buy your house, and the original owner said, fine, and then it ended up that it didn't happen because he bought it back from after 10 months. But you see that it's a little bit of a wrinkle over there, that it's kind of like a loophole within the rules of charging interest. So when I said before that there's a disincentive to buy a home outside of a walled city because it's all in favor of the original owner. The original owner is able to buy back the home right away or whenever he wishes. There's no cutoff time and there's no grace period. Plus, at the end of the term, at the Ovel, it's going to go back to the original owner. So there's no real incentive to do that. However, there is a slight incentive, which is you're rolling the dice a little bit, but you may end up living in a home for free for an extended period of time. Because if I come to you, you have a home outside of a walled city, and I pay you $100,000 for the home, it's going to go back to you in Yovel. But there's 40 years till Yovel. Well, if you come back to me in 10 years and give me back the $100,000, I have to give you back the home. But I lived in this home for 10 years, and I got my money back. Now, I don't know that that's going to happen. It doesn't have to happen, but it could happen. So there is a little bit of that can happen. Now, you see, here the Torah does not say that the price is prorated. It doesn't say that. Now, the truth is, as I'm speaking, I don't recall that the price is prorated. I don't believe it is when it comes to homes. When it comes to land, it says, the Torah says explicitly that the price is prorated. But with homes, I don't believe that it is. I can't say that with certainty, but I don't believe so. So that is the one wrinkle over here in this real estate transaction. It is very difficult to put yourself in another economic system. We're so used to what we're accustomed to. It's very difficult to think through what it's like if you're living at that time. The Gemara even says that when the Jews came to Israel, up until the first Yovel, people didn't really understand. They understood. They had the Torah, but they bought and sold land and homes as if they were out in a regular real estate market. But when the Yovel came and everything got switched back, then everybody realized, oh, one second, wait, it doesn't work that way. And then from then on, the way they handled the transactions were different. People caught on, sort of. It's different when you learn it theoretically and when you're living it. It's a completely different system. Yeah.
In the story of Naomi, did she own property? She had to own residence, but it's not mentioned.
Yeah, well, we don't know where she lived. She may have lived in a home on the property or not. I mean, it's possible. It's likely. Which actually brings up a point which I want to mention to you, which is if you go back to Pasuk Chafei 25, which we started with tonight, it says there, Ki yamucha chicha, when your brother shall become impoverished, umachar mei achuzaso, and will sell from his, how do they translate that? From his?
Part of his ancestral heritage.
Part of his ancestral heritage. That's a lot to say. Anyway, may, that prefix mem, means part of, from. So, Chazal say from here that a person should not sell their entire heritage, their entire land. Even if a person needs to sell, they should always hold on to part of it. They should not give up the entire thing. So your question of where do they live, it's likely they were living in a home on the property and they were not going to sell that part of the property. That's most likely the case. Okay, now, Pasuk Lamed Beis, verse 32, begins the discussion of the cities of the Levim. Now, the Levim, as you know, did not have land in Israel. The Levim were given, Levim here of course also means Kohanim. Kohanim and Levim together were given a total of 48 cities. These cities were scattered throughout Israel. They weren't all located in one place. All the tribes had some cities of Levim, of Kohanim and Levim. 48 different cities. Six are listed as the Arei Miklat, as the cities of refuge, which we'll speak about later on. Not tonight, but we'll get to it eventually. And then the other 42. The other 42 also functioned as cities of refuge, although there are some halakhic differences between the main six and the other 42. Again, we'll speak about that at another time. So there were 48 cities of the Levim. These 48 cities consisted of a central city where people lived, which was in turn surrounded by an area that was used for grazing and for growing crops, for grazing animals, which was in turn surrounded by an area of green space, just for a park, just so it should look nice. It's in the Torah. Green space. So we will have that when we get to it. We're not going to get to it tonight, but we will have the concept of Migrash and this concept of the area of the Levim. So the Levim had these areas. Now, the grazing area and planting area of the Levim was much smaller than for the other tribes, because all they had were cities. And this was the area immediately around the city. So it's not a very large area, certainly not commensurate to the amount of people that are living in the city. But that's what they had. Levim and Kohanim, their cities, the Torah wants to guard those cities because that's all they have. They have no access to anything else. This is the only way for the Levim and the Kohanim to live in Israel. Therefore, there are going to be rules in place to protect them that they should never lose their property. So they're going to be able to purchase back their houses, even in walled cities. They'll be able to get everything back at any time, and there's no concern for them losing permanently their homes and their fields. So Pasuk Lamed Beis 32 says, V'arei ha-Levim, the cities of the Levim, batei arei achuzasam, the homes of the cities of their ancestral heritage, geulas olam tiel ha-Levim, there will be geula, redemption forever for the Levim. They are not limited in when they can purchase back what they sell. They can purchase back immediately, and there is no deadline. They can continually purchase it back. The next pasuk, 33, Lamed Gimel, is difficult to translate. I'm just debating if we have enough time to cover this pasuk properly. All right, let's give it a shot, I think. At least let's read the simple translation. Vasher yigal min ha-Levim, someone who will redeem from the Levim. Here, the word redemption means, at least according to the simple translation, to purchase. Someone who will purchase a land or a home from the Levim. V'yatzamim karbayis v'irachuzaso bayovel, then the sale of the house and of the city of his ancestral heritage will go out in Yovel, which means it'll go back to the Levi. Kivate arei ha-Levim, for the cities of the houses of the cities of the Levim, hi achuzasam b'soch b'nei Yisrael, that is their ancestral heritage in the land of Israel, and therefore they have to get it back in Yovel. Usadei migrash arihem lo yimacher, and the fields of the area around their cities shall not be sold. Ki achuzas olam hi lahem, for it is an ancestral heritage for them forever, they cannot be sold. Now, the Pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 34, it cannot be sold. It does not mean they can't sell it. It's referring to a completely different case, which requires a great deal of explanation, which we're not ready to get to this evening. It's going to have to do with the field becoming hektish, given to the Beis HaMikdash, and a sale ensuing from that. So we're going to get to that at a later date. But the Pasuk Lamed Gimel 33 does have one other reading of the Pasuk, in addition to the way we read it originally. And that is that, let's say that a Levi sells his home. He sells his home. So we said that that home can be purchased back forever. It does not become owned by the person who bought it. What happens if another Levi buys it? Right. Maybe then that other Levi would hold on to it. Meaning maybe the Torah just wants to prevent non-Levium from getting a hold of the homes forever. But a Levi or a Kohen buying from a Levi or a Kohen, perhaps they can hold on to it. So that's why the Pasuk says, Vashri Yamina Levium, that if he's redeeming from the Levium, then again, even though it was a Levi who purchased from the Levi, or a Kohen from the Levi, or a Kohen from a Kohen, still, it can be purchased back forever. It does not. It's not just that the Torah wants the city to remain in the hands of the Levium and the Kohanim. The Torah wants the property to remain with the original owner, not just in the tribe, but the original would get it. As I said, though, there is more here, which actually has to do with some of the psukim we're going to learn later. So we're going to, Mirtz Hashem, get back to this at a later time.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.